Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Impact Michigan podcast presented by Intermittent. Intermittent is a grassroots volunteer-operated organization that was founded in 2016. Our mission is to unite the Midwest tech community, thoughtfully nurture its development, and highlight it as a hub of and destination for entrepreneurial talent and innovation. We're back with another Intermittent 2019 speaker, and the cool thing about this guest is that this will be their second time speaking at Intermittent. If you were there in 2017 for her talk on the benefits of being a bitch, then you'll be excited to hear that Laura Khalil is back and speaking about verbal self-defense. What is verbal self-defense, you ask? Well, you'll just have to listen and find out. Okay, more details on Laura. She's a public speaker, consultant, and life coach that focuses on helping women uncover their hidden power to lead extraordinary lives. After a career in Silicon Valley, being constantly told that she's too confident, too brash, and frankly, too much of a bitch, she struck out on her own as a consultant and since has been applauded for the same traits she was once reprimanded for. All right, with that intro, let's get into the episode. Hello.
Hi. Is this the show? Is this how we start?
Yeah, this is how we're gonna start. Welcome, Laura.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
I'm so happy you're on. We met for the first time. Was it the night before Intermittent?
Yes, it was at the party the night before Intermittent in 2018.
Yeah, and like in their Airbnb, it was in Corktown.
It was very hip. And I was so impressed by you. I was like, who is this guy? He is, like, I don't mean to be ageist, but when I was your age, like, I could barely, like, find my head from my ass. Like, I mean, seriously. Like, you're so put together. I'm very impressed.
Well, thank you. I'll pay you later.
It worked.
Yeah, so typically how I like to start this off is just always having my guest read their own bio just so I don't mess anything up.
Okay.
But tell the listeners, tell the world, who is Laura Khalil?
Yes, Laura Khalil. So hi, everyone. I am a personal development trainer. I'm based here in Detroit. I use a mix of comedy and storytelling along with a lot of research in human behavior. Are you going to die? Okay, don't die while I'm giving my bio. I mean, I don't mean to laugh either while you're dying.
It's okay. I just, you know, went down the wrong pipe.
Okay, allow me to continue.
All right, that was the last one.
Leanne, you are stealing my spotlight right now. God damn you!
All right. Let's start over.
Oh, okay.
Who is Laura Khalil?
So I am a personal development trainer based here in Detroit. I use a mixture of comedy and storytelling along with a lot of experience and research in human behavior to help individuals reach their highest potential. I tend to work primarily with women and allies of women as well. And that is because I think that women face some pretty unique challenges within the business world. My history is that I was working in the Bay Area in California for many years, really when I was cutting my teeth in tech. I worked as a technology marketer. I worked with a number of startups. And I was young, and so I experienced these things that I didn't know other men or other people might not be experiencing. For example, I was frequently told that I needed to smile more. I was actually put on a performance improvement plan, and one of the bullet points I had to improve on was that my frank way of talking was intimidating the men in the boardroom, and so I really needed to soften my language, quote unquote, to work with men. And I found that so surprising because I was talking the exact way they were talking, but I was getting really penalized for it. And I was constantly being told that either I was too much or I was not enough. And there was just sort of, it was like walking this tightrope where, you know, and many women know this, there's always a guy in the office that loves to come up to women and give them a back rub while, you know, he's saying hi to them. People don't typically appreciate that. They don't want to be touched. And so when you're in these office situations where you're trying to assert yourself, but if you're too assertive, you're too much. And if you tell someone to back off, they're like, God, why can't you just lighten up? And it's like, whoa, wait a minute here. Why can't we establish healthy boundaries and be respected for them? So my point in saying all that is that I was penalized for being a confident, outgoing woman in the full-time workforce in tech when I lived in the Bay Area. And in 2013, I had enough of this. I had been either laid off or moving from job to job, and I realized that the common denominator in all of my experiences was me, and that I could not give myself a personality lobotomy to meet the desires of what these guys wanted. And so instead, I was going to start my own business. So in 2013, I left my last full-time job and I started my own business because I knew I was competent. And I used the, I just was myself. I was confident. I was bold. I was outgoing. I'm pretty charismatic. And I am also deeply empathetic to people's needs. And all of that translated when I'd go and speak to clients into being an extremely trustworthy person to work with. And trust is the main thing you're looking for when you're looking for a consultant to work with or anyone. So I found that in the first 6 weeks of starting my own business, I got my first Fortune 500 client. I never worked with people at that level. And I thought, wow, this is what, I can't believe I sold them. Oh my God, like I must be a phony. And I thought, okay, maybe it's a fluke. Well, about 6 weeks later, I got my Fortune 5 client. Then I got another Fortune 500, another Fortune 500, and I realized that all of those traits that I was penalized for as an employee, for being too much, too bossy, the bitch, whatever you want to call it, they made me a visionary and a leader, and they actually helped me to gain an incredible amount of business and build a business that was frankly bigger than I had ever dreamed of. And I ran that business for over 5 years. And as I was running the business, people would come and ask me, Laura, how in the heck did you do this? Like, I was like thinking about it, and I'm thinking about like, how do I interact with people? How is that different? You know, and I started talking about it. So in 2017, I spoke at Intermittent for the first time, and my talk is The Benefits of Being a Bitch, which is a lot of this story that I'm sharing. And then I began to do more coaching with women around how they could also leave the corporate world if that's what they wanted, or if they wanted to get a raise, or if they wanted to move to the C-suite. I could also teach them that, because what I had actually learned through this experience was how we need to talk to people and how to address challenges and how to address when people say to you, why don't you smile more? You know, why don't you soften your language. I learned exactly how to address that. So that's what I teach today. And that's actually what I'm going to be teaching at Intermittent at my talk, which is called Verbal Self-Defense, The Art of Learning How to Speak Up for Yourself and Get What You Want, is teaching men and women how to defend themselves when they're in uncomfortable situations, bystander intervention, and really how to feel empowered when you feel like the power is taken away from you. Okay, so that's the world's longest bio. Hello.
No, I think it was great. I think you kind of captured. Yeah, I think you went in depth enough personally with the backstory, and then I think you kind of teed up some of the future topics that we'll talk about a little bit later in the episode. But I wanted to kind of bring it back to this sort of example that you brought on. You know, when you made the leap from corporate life to entrepreneurship, you landed your first Fortune 500 client, eventually your first Fortune 5, and you were essentially like beating out the imposter syndrome that was present. And I think a lot of first-time entrepreneurs, especially, you know, corporate to entrepreneurship and not just, you know, straight on into, I mean, even people straight on into entrepreneurship, honestly. I think anybody can really relate to this. How, you know, other than actually just, you know, putting the boots to the ground and working on your craft and your offering and your services, like, how did you deal with that initial imposter syndrome?
Well, I think there's two reasons why people fail in entrepreneurship. And this is particularly around solo entrepreneurship, but also small business. The first reason is you don't have a mentor. So you don't have anyone to teach you or show you the way. And a mentor is someone, in my eyes, who has done what you want to do or something similar to what you want to do. I had two mentors when I kicked off into the consulting entrepreneurial land, and I listened to everything they said. It didn't mean I took all their advice, but I listened to everything they said, and I knew that they were smarter than me. So find people who are smarter than you. The second reason why people fail, and this really gets at your point, is they don't have the self-worth to believe that they deserve this. So it's an inside job. You know, one of the interesting things, and a lot of my work is, as I said, around human behavior, and a lot of our human behavior looks towards neuroscience and specifically neurobiology. And what that really means is that we are always giving the world outside of us an experience of what the world inside of us is like. So if I am a mess internally, if I hate myself, if I say self-limiting things to myself every single day when I get up or constantly, if I keep telling myself what an idiot I am, that is neurobiologically shared, that data is shared as we go out into the world and meet other people. Mm-hmm. And that's powerful. Okay, that's your presence when you walk into a room. And so you have to learn your own self-worth. And I always believe that when you understand your self-worth, and what does that really mean? That means getting at the core of what you're here to do on this planet. Okay, so there, when I grew up, you know, I and my parents, I come from a very traditional Middle Eastern household. My father is Egyptian and my mom is Lebanese. And so in our culture, the way I was raised is, you're going to go to a really good school, and then you can get one of three jobs. You can be an engineer, you can be a doctor, or you can be a lawyer. These are your options. Then you're going to meet someone. He's going to take care of you, and he's going to support you. And then, and you know, but you'll still work, and then you'll have kids, and you'll work somewhere forever. And then you can have a little bit of fun, but not too much when you retire, and then you die. And so I grew up with that. So when I was very young, I got married. I went to a really good school. I was living my parents' wishes for my life without really considering what were my dreams? What did I want to do? You know, I was really trapped in other people's values. And so what I always teach people is you have to learn what you really value in life. And when you understand what it is for you, and there's a very specific process I take people through. I believe that in many ways your life is demonstrating what you value. But when you learn your highest values, you immediately begin to develop more self-worth. You become more, you have more attention towards things, more detail towards things, more retention of information. You become very self-directed. You know, you talk to any parent who has a child, they never need to be reminded to wake that kid up in the morning, to make them breakfast, and to go to school or get them on the bus by such and such time. They know that they have to do that. Why? Because their child is a very high value in their life. It's nobody needs to tell them to do that. It's internal inspiration to go do that. On the other hand, you take someone who wants to, let's say, or says they want to lose 20 pounds, but they don't go to the gym. They need people constantly checking on them, calling on them, gym buddies, trainers, everyone trying to motivate them. Mm-hmm. Motivation is an external force. Mm-hmm. So we try to motivate when we're trying to live from our lowest values. Mm-hmm. When we're living from our highest values, we're internally inspired. So if we try to follow our lower values, we don't have any self-worth because it's not what we really want. But when we live from our highest values, we do. So I encourage people to really start to figure out, what is it that I am uniquely capable of doing on this planet? What is my life demonstrating? Not just like fantasies, but what is my life demonstrating? And work with mentors and people who can help you get there.
Wow. I think that was really powerful. I think, so just to recap, you know, talking about imposter syndrome, number one, you said have a mentor. Number two, essentially figure out your self-worth, but the way you do that is not through, you know, I mean, it is somewhat tactical to have, you know, motivational, you know, talks and, you know, wake yourself up to, you know, some sort of motivational quote, but really it's setting a set of values that are high enough on your priority list, on your value list, to where in order to take action on something that you want to do, AKA, or for an example, essentially, you know, losing 20 pounds, mm-hmm. or let's say, you know, value is your child, and your child's health, then set that up high enough on your value priority list so that you're intrinsically motivated and not just worrying about, you know, other people to keep you accountable.
Exactly. I would say you're intrinsically inspired instead of externally motivated to go do it. And there are definite ways to move things up on the value list, but it takes work. It's more work than just saying, I'm going to make it a value. It's really rearranging your life around understanding how and why that's so important to you and why it supports the other things that are really important to you.
Yeah, interesting. So like, what would you, to kind of continue on this topic, what would you suggest is a way for people to start mapping out their values and start, you know, rearranging it as easy as it seems?
Absolutely. So I would ask a series of questions to them. And these questions are not about what you want the answer to be, but they're actually about what your life is demonstrating. Mm. So I would be asking them questions about, where do they spend their money? What do they surround themselves with at work and at home? What do they think about and actualize in their life? Not just think about, because a lot of us are in this generation now of just getting trapped in our heads. Mm. But what do they think about and actualize? What do they talk about and realize? What do they read about? What are they, what goals are they setting that are showing signs of coming true? Mm. You know, a lot of us will say, and I can't tell you how many people I talk to who say things like, you know, I really want to quit my job. I really want to quit my job. And a year goes by, I really want to quit my job. And I'm like, I don't believe you. I think that you actually have a very high value on staying in this job because this job is related to something that's really important to you. Mm-hmm. That could be money. That could be that you really want to make this amount of money and you haven't figured out how to make that money doing it on your own. So you're going to stay there. It could be that you really thrive in a structured environment and that freelancing or starting your own business is way too unstructured for you. And that's a challenge for many new entrepreneurs or new freelancers, mm-hmm. That you learn how to get over time, or at least I have. So that's how I would start looking at it, is what is life demonstrating to you? And I take clients through 13 specific questions on that, and I gave you about half of them and don't have the rest of them in front of me, unfortunately, but that's what I would start asking. And then I would start ranking, mm-hmm. and I'd say, well, what does this really signify? What does it really mean that you have this in your life? And let's get to the bottom of that. Any client that works with me, that's exactly where I start, you know, is figuring out their values. Because once we figure out what their life is demonstrating and they say, oh, you know, Laura, I really don't like that. I'm not happy with how this looks. Then I say, that's okay. Mm-hmm. Because now we can figure out how to modify values and how to adjust them. But you got to know where you're starting. It's just like when you get on the scale, like you want to lose weight, right? So you have to get on the scale. You have to know your baseline. Where am I starting at? It's the same thing with figuring out your values.
Yeah, definitely. And I think, you know, over time, especially as we start thinking about this and as people start to question kind of what their day-to-days are and what exactly is not necessarily motivating them, but what is causing them to act. Mm-hmm. And once you start to you know, dig deeper behind mm-hmm. those actions and where they come from, I think you really start to, you know, paint a picture for yourself.
Absolutely. You know, there are two main things that keep people behind, and they're shame and guilt. Mm. There's shame and guilt about money. There's shame and guilt about success. There's shame and guilt about all kinds of things, which is this really a fear of not living up to someone else's value system. Mm. That's all that is. But, you know, at the end of the day, the only thing you can do is live within your highest values. That's mm-hmm. it. You can't live in anyone else's values. Just like I couldn't do what my parents wanted for me, you know, in getting this, you know, picture perfect marriage and stable job and all that stuff, which just blew up because it wasn't what I really wanted. What my parents gave me was the gift of stability growing up. I had a very stable childhood. We lived in a good neighborhood, went to good schools. You know, you don't realize how lucky you are as a kid. I'm not saying it was all roses, but mm-hmm. you don't realize how lucky you are as a kid until you grow up and you meet other people and you really mm-hmm. get some perspective.
Yeah.
But because of the stability that I grew up with and never having to worry about having food on the table or if we were going to be under a roof, I grew up and I wanted something else from my life. I wanted to go out and I wanted to explore. I wanted to be an entrepreneur, but I was always too afraid to do it because of what my parents would think, because of their fear of rejection from my community. And so when I talk about those bosses that I had in the past saying, hey, Laura, could you just smile more? Could you soften your language? You know, what I want to say is I'm not upset with them. These guys were actually my greatest teachers. Mm. They were teaching me that, yes, from their perspective, I was a bitch. But the other side of the coin was that I was really a leader and I was just in the wrong roles. And if nobody had told me that, I never would have become an entrepreneur. You know, I had to go through that experience to realize where I was actually meant to be. So when we can have gratitude for these things that happen to us, we can be fully present in the moment and not living in the past and our anger and misery over this stuff.
Kahoots is a uniquely inspiring tech hub designed to help our members and community thrive. They bring together a community of diverse people who share a passion for making amazing technology and building companies. Their cultural foundation is born from a common perspective of taking risk, getting stuff done, seeking their personal best, and having a positive impact. And fun fact, Intermittent is proud to be headquartered at Kahoots. All right, with that, let's get back to the episode. You spoke at Intermittent in 2017.
Yep.
How did that happen? How did you meet Heidi? How did you learn of the conference?
So at that point, I was working out of Bamboo Detroit, which is a co-working space here in Detroit. And I like to joke that the founder or co-founder of Bamboo Detroit, Amanda Luan, was kind of like my unofficial agent. And so she would always say, Laura, I think you, have you heard of this? I think you should apply to this. I think you should apply to that. And she said, hey, Laura, there's this thing called Intermittent. Do you want to go speak at it? And I was like, I don't think they're going to accept me. Like, this looks like a big deal. And it is a big deal. And, but I applied. I followed my quote unquote agent's advice. Thank you, Amanda. And I applied. And sure enough, I was absolutely flabbergasted when they invited me to come. And I thought, okay, now we're ready. And so that's how I met Heidi Kron, who's one of the founders of Intermittent. And Heidi and I were going, you know, they do an amazing job with what I love about this event is they do an amazing job with the speakers prior to the event of really prepping them to make sure their talks are on point and ready and rehearsed before the day of. So you're not seeing something that someone threw together the night before after some wild pre-show bender, and it's like a nightmare. You know what I'm talking about. You've been to these events. It's really well done. And so I was talking to her about my story, and she said to me, you know, Laura, what do you think if we call it the benefits of being a bitch? And I was sort of like, oh, that's scary. I don't know if I want that word associated with me. But I thought, you know what? That's going to get people's attention. So let's do it. So we did.
Yeah, that's awesome. And I think, honestly, it's what's the word? Polarizing in a way where, you know, I think anything really that's polarizing is literally the definition of polarizing, which is it attracts those who are attracted to it and, you know, detracts, is that the right word?
Repels,
you know, the people that it wouldn't resonate with anyway, that you don't want to
resonate
with.
Which is totally fine. And I just have to say this. It is a complete fantasy to think that everyone is going to like you. So it's just like when you look at the scales of justice, they're always balanced. One mm-hmm. isn't like leaning more towards one way or the other. That's the same thing with human beings. So whenever I go into a talk, I try to give the best talk I can and really speak to the audience. But I recognize that for about half the people, they're not really going to be with it. Maybe it's not their thing. Maybe they don't need this talk. Mm-hmm. The other half of the people are really going to dig it. They're going to be like, oh, yeah, cool. I'm learning something. And about 20% of them are going to come up to me and say, Laura, this talk changed my life. And I know that sounds bombastic, but the only reason I say it is because every time I talk, someone comes up to me and says that. And so I know I'm making a difference.
Yeah. And I think also, you know, if I haven't seen your talk, but if your talk was anywhere near like this, I think it makes sense that it's changing people's lives, because I think people need to hear that. And I think, you know, having that information and having just that sort of realization within the, you know, 30 or 45 minutes that, you know, someone's giving a talk, I think that's the first step. And the first step is, you know, making that sort of switch in your mind. It's like, oh, okay. Like whether it's connecting through your story and it's like, oh, you know, if she can do it, you know, that gives me permission to do it as well. And then also, you know, the roadmap and the framework that you've built through your own story and like, oh, okay, I at least have a first step that I can take here.
Absolutely. And I will say another thing. I did come from a very privileged background in that my parents had a very stable environment for me. But when I was 27, I got divorced. I was kicked out of my house and I was homeless for 6 weeks. And I had nothing. So I want to say to anybody who is in trying circumstances, I believe in you and I fully believe in your ability to get out of this, to figure it out, and to pick yourself up and to get support from your community. It is absolutely possible. I mean, like, if I can do it, I really believe in the power of anyone to be able to do this stuff.
Yeah, definitely. So moving on to essentially one of the things that you're working on right now, Force of Badassery.
Yes.
Do you mind kind of giving us a little cliff notes of the description there?
Yep. So I was speaking at an event a couple of years ago called Ladies Get Paid. That is an event that is about pay parity for women. And they invited me on to speak. And I was telling them about all of the things that I'm doing and the clients that I have. And I was organizing creative salons and other events. And the woman on the phone said to me, she said, Laura, you are like a force of badassery. And I said, you know what? I kind of like that. Okay. So I made business cards. I thought that was kind of cute. And so I made business cards and I put it on it. And then I thought, you know what? Let me just buy the URL. I couldn't believe it was available. And so that really is my website where you can go learn about me. I have regularly updated blog posts really about in my mission, turning women into badasses. And what does that mean? Having the courage to do the things that are really scary instead of hiding behind just being nice. You know how many people hide behind that stupid phrase? I'm so tired of it. Yes, don't be a dick, okay? But too often we hide behind, well, I was just trying to be nice. And so we don't actually voice what we need in a situation, voice how we're feeling, and we really shrink and we're small. So forceofbadassery.com is all about my coaching services, speaking services, and inspiration for women and allies who want to be badasses. That's it, man.
That's awesome. So, okay. To sort of go more into that, what is maybe one piece of advice you would give to someone who is looking to tap into their inner force of badassery?
Let me think about that. I would challenge them to begin to account for the moments when they experience joy in their life.
Mm.
You know, is it listening to a great piece of music that brings like a tear to your eye? Is it an amazing piece of literature? Is it a great show? Is it giving a presentation? Is it talking to someone on the phone? Is it something related to your work? What gives you joy? And I think we get so removed from that. And joy is one of those things. One, it's infectious.
Mm-hmm.
So when you have it, you can't help but spread it. It makes life and the day seem timeless. So you can just keep doing this thing over and over. You're actually in flow when you're in joy. And it is really a source of inspiration. And it's not a mystery. Joy isn't a mystery. It's not something that we can't figure out. So I'd first start by asking people to tap in and really start, even write it down, especially, when do I feel joyful? Like, I mean, I was observing this myself the other day. I got a call to do another speaking gig, and I was on the phone with them, and we were sort of walking through the gig, and I thought to myself, oh my God, I am so joyous in this moment to be able to share this work with the world. I'm feeling energized. I'm feeling alive. And I realized, I'm like, okay, yeah, I'm on the right path. Yep, that's what I'm supposed to be doing. So look for the joy.
Yeah, and I would even suggest, I think you suggested this actually, like writing it down and taking mental note of it. And,
yeah.
But, and not even just taking mental note, but even like, I mean, if your smartphone's in your pocket during that moment, like take a picture of what's around you. Like, because for me, what that kind of popped up in my mind was a lot of times, you know, one of the biggest things that makes me feel joy is when I'm traveling, you know, even if it's somewhere that I've been before, like if it's novel enough and if it's unique enough, like I just, like when I was riding the subway in New York City, which a lot of people hate because it's part of their daily commutes, it's just something that they, you know, have to take from A to B.
Totally.
But for me, it was like, wow, this is really cool. And like my first time that a subway performer was performing, and I just like had to take it in. I was like, wow.
And let me ask you, what did you love about that experience?
I think the characteristics of it was that it was new. It was something that, you know, other people experienced as part of their lives that I was getting to experience for the first, second, and third time, where for me, a lot of the joy that I get from experiences like those are just the simple fact that it's like I'm living another person's life, that I'm living another person's experience.
And you bring up this great point, though, is you're alive.
Mm.
When we're joyous, we're really, it's a feeling of being alive, you know? Joseph Campbell, who is one of my great teachers, a famed mythologist, for those of you who don't know him, he's very famously quoted for the quote, follow your bliss. And The Power of Myth is one of his specials, which, by the way, is on Netflix. Anyhow, he says the point of life is not happiness. You know, as we all try to like be happy, the point of life is to experience that feeling of being alive.
Mm.
Right. And so I think joy really brings us into that feeling.
Yeah. I think to go off of that point, you know, life, it isn't about happiness. It's like, I almost view it as kind of like a line, and it kind of blips up or down,
mm-hmm.
you know, kind of like a heart rate
kind
of thing. And it's like, you have to experience full spectrum of emotions. And it's like, you know, I try to do this right now, which is like, anytime I'm feeling any sort of emotion, it's just feeling it and taking note of it and kind of just sitting in it.
Yep.
And saying like, yeah, okay, I'm sad right now. I'm angry right now. I'm really happy right now.
You are so evolved. I mean, this is amazing. You know, I had a therapist on my podcast. We were talking about addiction to drama and attachment styles. And she said something really amazing. She said, every feeling has a beginning, a middle, and most importantly, an end. Mm. And we in this culture are so used to really just getting the beginning of a feeling and never processing the rest of it because we're always on to the next thing, or we're always shoving it down, or we're always trying to distract ourselves with our phones or whatever it may be, that we don't actually get to really fully move through and process feelings. So mm-hmm. we end up carrying a lot of baggage on our backs.
Yeah. And I think even, you know, a lot of times for me, when I feel anxious, it used to be more so a reaction, but now I've had to kind of retrain myself to do it, but just kind of doing, you know, some mindfulness exercises, some just, again, like literally and physically sitting in it, right? And just sitting with my thoughts and just allowing the sort of trains and the cars to kind of just in my head just, you know, pass.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think, I don't know. I did Headspace for like 10 days, which was like the free trial or whatever. But
Was it good? Should we get it?
I liked it. I mean, I didn't pay for it because I was like, oh, I got what I need.
Okay.
I got the framework that works for me. But the way so it's a guided meditation, right? So the guide, the way he sort of essentially taught me and the way I learned and the way I do it now is, you know, think of your thoughts as you're sitting on a bridge and you're overlooking a highway, you know, two directions, four lanes, whatever. And the cars are going to your left, they're going to your right. Think of all of those cars as your thoughts. And so instead of getting caught up in just the busyness of every single car, which is a thought, just as one car passes, focus on it. And as it's moving across, you know, your visual area, and it soon gets out of sight, go on to the next car. Mm-hmm. So go on to the next thought. And it's not a bad thing to have those thoughts and have those cars when you're meditating, at least in this style of meditation. But what's important is you move on to the next one. And eventually, you calm yourself down. And that is how I do things now. And I think now with all of my thoughts just kind of running and allowing myself to think through things, that's kind of how I sort of, deal with you know, anxiety is just, especially, you know, from, situations mm-hmm. that I'm currently in. Like it's literally just, you know, think through things, you know, like I'm a huge fan of game theory, and it's just literally like, think, you know, you make this decision, you know, A, B, C happens. Okay. What happens if you choose C? Then, you know, the other person or the other party will react this way, and you got to do this. Mm-hmm. And like, that's like, I have to think my way through the end or until I get bored. Cause once I get bored, then I'm like, oh, okay. It's not that big a deal.
Yeah. I mean, there's not really anything. I don't believe in the fear of the unknown. That's just mm-hmm. the fear of not, you just don't have a plan. So to your point, just make a plan.
Yeah.
And make a plan for the contingencies that scare you. And that's how you work on getting over that fear.
Yeah.
One of the things I always tell clients, and one of the things I do for fear, is an exercise from Julia Cameron's book, The Artist's Way. Mm. Whether or not you're an artist, I recommend everyone get this book. It is The 12 Weeks to Creative Recovery. It's 12 weeks for anyone to really capture their creative recovery, whether you're a heart surgeon, attorney, tech person, or little old me. The first exercise is to do what she calls morning pages.
Yeah.
So often we're trying to shut down the critic, right? We're trying to shut down the bad feelings and not allow them. You allow them to pass through. Julia Cameron in her exercise says, sit down and write 3 pages stream of consciousness every morning. Do not edit yourself. Do not reread them. It is literally to clear the gunk and garbage out of your head and give it a place to go. Give it a place to live. Stop pushing it down and get it out. And then you can go on with your day. And you know what? If you do that and you do that over the course of, I do this in fits and starts. So usually I'll start doing it and then I'll do it for a week and I'll be like, oh man, it's getting hard. Oh, what do I write about? But if you can stick with it, you get into this amazing space because you're finally freeing your head up from all this crap.
Yeah. And I feel like, I think I'm definitely, one, I'm definitely going to start doing morning pages, but I think, you know, one of the reasons why morning pages works is because you're writing it down and you're like handwriting it down.
You're right. Handwriting it.
Yeah. Because I think like for me, my mind moves 1,000 miles a minute and like I can have so many different thoughts kind of balancing in my head, but writing something down, like the goal is to be somewhat coherent, at least form sentences. But it's like as you're writing something down, you're forced to write one letter at a time, one word at a time, one sentence at a time. And so it's like it kind of collapses all those different thoughts into one sort of excrement. I don't know if that's the right word.
Like one stroke at a time, you're sort of releasing it. It's really a form of meditation.
Mm-hmm.
It is tough, but it's worth it.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Challenge for myself.
Okay. There we go. I'll check
one
in
week
on you.
At least. Okay. Cool. So sort of wrapping things up here. I don't know how long we've been going, but it looks like we've been going a while.
Would you like me to talk about what I'm doing at intermittent?
Yes. Maybe even give us a little snippet. Yeah.
So one of the workshops that I lead is around verbal self-defense. And that's what I'll be speaking on at intermittent. What that really is if you are a person who has had to deal with mansplaining, catcalling, being talked over, being interrupted, feeling like you are less than, like your boss doesn't understand you, like you are working below your potential and you just don't kind of understand like how to fix this situation you're in. That's what verbal self-defense is about. It relies on techniques from martial arts, specifically Aikido, and also from hostage negotiation. And so in both of those things, what we're trying to do, when we talk about Aikido, what we're trying to do is we're trying to gracefully and artfully disarm our opponent without doing them any harm.
Mm-hmm.
And verbal self-defense is the same way. When we're in hostage negotiation, not that I have been in hostage negotiation, but what I have learned from it is we're also trying to safely disarm a person and situation without anyone dying, without any harm coming to anyone. Everyone walks out. And so that's the same thing with verbal self-defense. We use verbal techniques that are, you know, like, let me explain it this way. So this often happens to women. When I've mentioned several times now when I was in the workforce, things people would say to me. When I have given this workshop, I've had women come in and say things like, on the first day of work, I went into my office and my hiring manager said to me, I never wanted to hire a woman anyway. Huh. Can you imagine hearing that on your first day at the office? I had another student who her job was to work with employees who had accounting requests to rectify them. Her manager became so upset with her capability in this role and that he was kind of threatened by it, that she walked into the office one day and found her desk pushed against a wall. So she was facing a wall for 12 hours a day or 8 hours a day instead of facing the employees who she was meant to interact with. Mm. What do you do with that? Or what about a situation, especially for young women who are new in the workforce? This is one that I also had a student tell me about. She was an engineer on a job site. There was a guy who had some ambiguous sexual innuendo towards her. So he was trying to help her out of his car in a way that she didn't need help, and she was a little uncomfortable about it. And ladies, trust yourself. When you feel that, that's real. That feeling is real. You know something's up. Later in the day, he made a comment to her about her being a good little girl, which also rather inappropriate. And by the end of the day on this job site that was very, very hot, it was a construction site, he said, you know, you look really hot. Can I hose you down? And because she didn't know what to do, she allowed it. Now, that's not to blame her for that. But that's to say, when we don't know how to respond to this behavior, it doesn't go away. It escalates. Mm-hmm. And these people need to learn boundaries and that it is not okay to talk to people that way. So in verbal self-defense, what I will be teaching at Intermittent and what I teach in my workshops in greater detail is how to deal with this situation in a way that isn't saying to someone, hey, F you, you jerk. You know, that's not very artful. Certainly, you know, maybe in some scenarios you will want to use that. But when I talk with people, I'm talking often about how do we do this in the workplace, right? Mm-hmm. You're not going to say that to your manager. You know, people meet a manager and or they're on a job interview and it's going really well. And at the end of it, he says, so are you married? You know, and that could be an innocuous question, but it also might not be. And you don't really know. And so learning how to artfully respond to these things is what I teach in a way that doesn't make women look like bitches, doesn't make women look like they're emotional or aggressive or too much. It really helps them take them off the spot and take the pressure off them because we freeze up, right? Like we freeze up in these moments when guys talk to us this way. We don't know what to say. And so they think that means we're okay with it, but we're not okay. We're just stuck and frozen. So I teach women how to break out of that freeze response.
Yeah. And I think that's an important point. I mean, there's a lot of things I want to highlight there, but I think the last thing that you spoke to, you freeze up. The reason, I think one of the reasons why, at least in my experience, is like when you want to respond correctly, and mm-hmm. a lot of times correctly means professionally and respectfully without pissing the other person off. So you freeze because a lot of times you're grasping for those words that you want to utter and
you just can't put them together.
But it's like they're not there.
Right.
And so I think one, having specific, you know, go-to phrases or, you know, go-to tactical ways of approaching that response.
Yeah, and very tactical responses where you don't have to think.
Yeah.
So you bring up a great point. And I want to say to the audience, I'm giving a lot of examples of women in these situations, but you and I have discussed prior to the show, this stuff happens to men too. And this stuff happens in bystander intervention when we see something happening and we don't know what to say. So this work is applicable to all kinds of people in different scenarios. And I don't want to exclude men when I talk about it. We'll definitely be including them. But absolutely, what's happening is the amygdala, which is our reptilian brain, the oldest part of our brain, controls our fight, flight, and freeze response. And it is fast. It works quickly. And it is the part of our brain that says, oh my gosh, there's a bear. Freeze, right? The newer part of our brain is the prefrontal cortex. This is our reasoning brain. This is where you're trying to find the words. You're trying to be logical. You're trying to think it through. But that's a much younger part of the brain, and it's slower. And so it takes more time for it to respond and to think through and logic its way out of a problem. So when we feel threatened, the amygdala is like, I'm here, online, let's go, fight, flight, or freeze. And this may not be a situation where we need fight, flight, or freeze. Mm-hmm. This may be a situation, and often is a situation where we need to speak up, but we don't know how to. And so by using verbal self-defense, we gain ourselves a few seconds, and that's all we need to take the pressure off us, to redirect it right back at the person who asked the question with the same intensity, and to give our prefrontal cortex a moment to come online and think of an appropriate response.
Yeah. And I think so to highlight another point there, I think it's really important to understand like why it's important to focus on the disarming at first. Because I think a lot of times, especially in the professional environment, like a lot of the, I don't want to say a lot, but like some, you know, chunk of these interactions will be innocuous. They will be, you know, just, they could be misinterpreted to
totally.
Where it's like, oh, you know, somebody could either mean bad or good by it. Or just,
or mean nothing at all.
Yeah, exactly.
They're not even thinking most of the time.
And so like you know, if there is a response that's, you know, oh, go fuck yourself, then it's like,
please don't say that.
What, what'd you just say to me?
Yeah, right. And then you're amping it up. You're mm-hmm. making it worse. And we don't want to make it worse. What we want to do is we want to get curious. Mm-hmm. And so we don't want to attack anyone. We never attack. And I want to say something else. Just because someone asks you a question or makes a statement at you, you don't need to respond to that. You know, we're told when someone asks you a question, answer. And I want to say, when someone asks you a question, you don't need to do anything about that. You look at any great politician. Come on, guys. They don't answer questions. Yeah. They answer the questions they want to answer. But that's part of it, is we have to relearn something we were often taught as children. And yeah. relearn what it means, especially for women, to be nice, you know? We have this idea of being nice as acquiescing, mm-hmm. of not making any waves. The man is right. Certainly that's how I was raised. And it's a constant fight for me. I mean, I know probably to your audience, there's people listening to this being like, wow, she sounds like a tough as nails bitch. And
I hope not.
But, you know, I am a quote unquote strong woman, but I also have challenges just like any other person in trying to be delicate, in trying to be empathetic, in trying to be caring towards my audience and the individuals I'm working with.
Yeah. Well, look, if anybody wants more, I imagine there would be a lot that want more of these tactics, more of this information, more of Laura Khalil.
Can I do a shout out on the show?
Yeah, sure.
I am single, gentlemen.
There we go.
So this cues me getting these very bizarre emails.
Oh man.
You know, they say if you don't put it out there, people aren't going to know.
That's a good point.
Okay, so
that's
I'm putting it out there. And yeah. obviously I'm a very aggressive lady. So
So all right. Disregard Tinder, disregard Bumble, disregard Hinge, The League, all of your dating apps. Just come to Intermittent.
Laura will be there.
Laura will be there giving her talk on verbal self-defense.
But also, yes, if people want to find out more, come to Intermittent. Find me at forceofbadassery.com. And I would love to connect with you, truly. I mean, I give the verbal self-defense workshops almost every month where we really go in depth into this stuff. And I also do the values training one-on-one with people. And I'm starting up some group coaching soon. So
awesome.
Stay tuned.
Nice. So last question here to wrap us up. Laura, what is the impact that you want to have on the world?
I really want people to learn that the strongest, the bravest, the most courageous thing they can do is speak up for themselves. Mm. Truly. And I don't mean that just in a verbal self-defense way, but really even say to themselves, what do I really want out of this life? You know, this one precious life. How do I want to live it? What is the feeling of being alive that I want? What are the experiences I want to share with others? This sounds cliche, but the truth is our greatest gift is to be ourselves and share it with the world. And we spend the first half of our lives putting on so many masks of trying to be a good son or daughter, a good spouse, a good student, a good employee. And we spend the second half of our life learning how to take them off, learning how to really sit with ourselves and who are we under all of these personas that we wear. And how can we really bring that out into the world? It's all about serving others. So when you can figure out your value to the world as your authentic self, that's an amazing gift to share. Don't waste it.
And with that, thank you so much for coming on the show.
It's a pleasure to be here.
All right, everyone. That was Laura Khalil, the force of badassery. Check her out at Intermittent 2019, June 4th, where she'll give you the battle-tested tips and tricks to verbal self-defense. If you're listening to this show, odds are you'll love the lineup at Intermittent. Speakers include local renowned experts like Doe Security's Doug Song, Backstage Capital's Monica Wheat, Build Institute's April Boyle, and so many more. Tickets cost $100 and can be purchased through the link in the show notes or on intermittent.org. That's intermittent.org. Final answer. See, it is like a spelling bee. Use the discount code PODCAST for $10 off your ticket during checkout. See you there.